Excerpt from a pamphlet titled A Tempest in Suffolk. Sunday, being the 4th of this August in the year of our Lord, 1577, to the amazing and singular astonishment of the present beholders, at a certain town called Bungay, not 10 miles past the city of Norwich, there fell from heaven an exceeding great and terrible tempest, sudden and violent, between 9 of the clock in the morning and 10 of the day aforesaid. This tempest took beginning with a rain, which fell with wonderful force, with no less violence than abundance, which made the storm so much the more extreme and terrible. This tempest was not simply of rain, but also of lightning and thunder, the flashing of the one whereof was so rare and vehement, and the roaring noise of the other so forcible and violent, that it made not only people perplexed in mind and at their wits' end. There were assembled at the same season to hear divine service and common prayer, according to order, in the parish church of the said town of Bungay, the people thereabouts inhabiting who were witnesses of the strange and suddenness of the storm. Immediately hereupon there appeared in a most horrible similitude and likeness to the congregation then in their present, a dog, as they might discern it, of a black color, at the sight whereof, together with the fearful flashes of fire that were seen, moved such admiration in the minds of the assembly that they thought doomsday was already come. This black dog, or the devil in such likeness, running all along down the body of the church with great swiftness and incredible haste, among the people in a visible form and shape, passed between 2 persons as they were kneeling upon their knees and occupied in prayer, as it seemed, wrung their necks of them both at one instant clean backward, insomuch that even in a moment where they kneeled, they strangely died. The Black Beast of Bungay, next on Monster Talk.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I can hardly believe it, but this is our 50th episode. It seems like only yesterday when we were talking to Todd DeSotel about DNA and Bigfoot for our very first episode. I've learned a lot so far, and hopefully you have too. Today, Ben, Karen, and I discuss legends of spectral hounds with Professor David Waldron. David's a frequent contributor at our Facebook group, so if you have questions after this episode, come on over and post them.
Monster Talk.
Tonight we're going to, I always say tonight, you know, it might not be tonight. Our listeners could be getting up
something.
In the morning. Yeah.
Yeah.
At some random time of day. Wow. But the right time to listen to Monster Talk would be at night, right?
You would think so.
Just before bed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, just before you have to walk upstairs in the dark to bed, right? So.
Yeah.
Or either that or listen to it just before you go to investigate that weird noise in the basement.
Yeah, exactly.
On a stormy night.
Have you ever actually had like a weird noise in your house, an unusual noise that you needed to go investigate?
Yes.
I remember when
Aren't
I was
we all?
Yeah. I was engaged to get married and still living in sin, if you know what I mean. And one night there was like a really loud bang, like somebody was banging on the outside door to our apartment. We lived on the ground floor. And, my wife, I was sleeping right through it, apparently. And my wife, like, woke me up and said, there's something banging on the house. There's something out there. I looked up. I was like, who is it?
She wasn't your wife then.
Well, she wasn't. She is now. So, but I said, who is it? And she looked at me like, with like this absolute look of disgust and said, I'll take care of it. And she got out of bed to go see what it was. I went back to sleep. She still brings that up 12 years later.
Very, very manly of you.
I was more tired
Who
than
is
afraid.
It?
Right?
Don't hurt us.
Go away. I'm asleep.
But I think we've got lots of creatures living in the roof of our house here, and there's always some strange noise outside. And I guess this is Colorado, lots of wildlife, and
we have to do a show about Jeff
Creaking, yes, we do. Creaking house noises, settling house noises, and all that sort of stuff.
I have big plans for Jeff. I don't want to just do a little overview. I want to do something very special for that. So the Talking Mongoose for the listeners who don't know Jeff. We have to do something really good for that. I have something in mind. I have something in mind. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I'll have to cut this part out. But here's what I want to do.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Sounds like an awesome idea.
I think that'd be fun.
All right.
So black dogs.
Black dogs. But I have to tell you that, do you guys have a favorite black dog story? Or was that anything that it really figured into your upbringing folklore-wise?
I think growing up in Australia, it was more big cats than dogs, really.
Ben?
I got bit by Doberman.
Okay. For me, I think we've talked before about, I think we all come from a background of having read a lot of paranormal books growing up.
Right.
The Devon Hound is this weird black dog that has no head. And when I was a kid reading about that dog, I was like, I don't know why. Like, as an adult, I'm like, why would the dog have no head? That is not that scary to me. But like,
he's driving a coach.
As a kid, he was headless and he drove a coach underneath the cabinet. And then the dog would other dogs would try to get after the food. You were a little commercial with the little wagon that would run under
the gravy train.
Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff. Anyway, I love black hounds. And of course, they also figured into the Harry Potter stories. The Grimm, right? As an omen. So
why are they always black?
Yeah, what's up with that? Exactly. Right.
Racist, I think.
Why's it got to be a black dog? Right. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, from a folklore point of view, from what I recall is that there were a couple main colors that were associated with the devil, and they were black and red.
Yeah,
not so much green or blue or anything. Yeah, so it makes sense that that the things that are perceived to be demonic or unusual or otherworldly would probably be either or black or red or often as Karen noted, black and red. Black creatures with red eyes. Same thing with a chupacabra.
And the University of Georgia.
Red eyes?
No, black and red and a dog.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So I can tell you an actual true story involving a black dog that happened to me. If you're interested, I think.
Tell us.
I had you wouldn't know this by looking at me, but I used to be an avid runner. And before I joined the Navy, I had to lose quite a bit of weight, but I ran all the time. And I'd run at night because I was working during the day. And near my neighborhood, in my neighborhood, there was a woman who had this dog, a big black Labrador, that her husband ran a junkyard. And it was basically a junkyard dog in the classic sense of the word. But it was pretty friendly, and it used to chase me. And then at some point, it just started running with me for part of my run. It would run from its house, maybe two blocks, and then it would kind of drop off and go back home. But it was friendly. It was a very friendly dog, but a very strange looking dog because it had an underbite, and so its lower jaw, its teeth actually came out past its upper, not a lip, but whatever the upper part of a dog's mouth is called. And then it only had one eye. It had the other eye had been torn out in a dog fight. Christ. And it was covered in scars, big heavy set dog though. But it became a regular part of my running routine that when I passed her house, the dog would be out there, come join me for my run, and then I'd go off into the distance, and then eventually it would drop off. And I liked that; it was kind of fun. And then when I got out of the Navy and came back home, I asked about the dog, and my mom told me that what had happened was the dog had died. I think it was hit by a car, and so I was like, oh, that's so sad. I'd only been out, of the Navy for a little while, and I started running there in my home neighborhood. And one night I was out running and I heard something behind me and turned around and there was the dog. And it scared the blue Jesus out of me. I think I ran faster than I've ever run before. It was trying desperately to keep up with me, but I was like, hell no. Right.
Was it the dog?
Well, what happened was, I ran away and then found a different way to get back home. And then the next morning I went over to her house and asked her about the dog. And I said, my mom said your dog died. And then she gave me a funny look and she said, well, the dog catcher was after me because I kept him off his leash all the time. So I told them it died. And I only let him out late at night.
Wow. Interesting. That is a cool story. I was thinking
this was sounding like one of those hitchhiker stories.
Yeah, it so yeah, the dog was actually the dog was still alive but had become an inside the house dog. Except occasionally she'd let it out at night, and I just happened to witness it. But I was really glad she came clean with me. Otherwise, I would have had yet another not paranormal experience that I thought was paranormal on my
great story.
Yeah, so creepy dog to see. But I tell you, it was really, I mean, if you're going to see a dog that's ghostly, you know, that weird, it's white teeth gleaming and the one eye. It had a fearsome appearance, but a gentle disposition. So I thought that was kind of fun and topical. So
very.
Yeah. So I've read a lot of these legends, I think the alien big cats, these, you know, big cats that are in places where they shouldn't be, like in England and whatnot, get a lot more press these days than black dog stories.
Yeah, that's what I found. I mean, you know, especially like in 14 Times and elsewhere, it's usually the ABCs, the alien black cats that people are yelling about.
Yeah.
I wonder if people just find them somehow more plausible.
Maybe, but they do seem to have a really strong, you know, spiritual connection. I mean, in the book that we are going to be talking about, in the book, you know, he talks about it being like an omen, almost, that people associated seeing the dog with bad things happening. But I found it very interesting because in this legend of this black dog of Bungie, the dog, its first appearance is this horrific and fatal appearance inside a church, and you know, I'd always sort of imagine coming up from a very, you know, religious background that if you were inside a church, that's one place where you might be immune to the scourge of evil.
You would think.
So it'll be interesting to find out what's up with that. So
Monster Talk.
Today we're going to talk to Dr. David Waldron, who is a lecturer in history and anthropology at the University of Ballarat, and he's also the co-author of Shock, the Black Dog of Bungay.
So, how can I help you?
Okay, David, what's the main story of the Black Dog of Bungay?
Well, the main story of the Black Dog of Bungay is that in 1577, on August 4th, in what was described at the time of a storm of rain, hail and thunder, such as never seen the like, is how they put it at the time, the story goes that the main church there in St. Mary's, in the centre of town, was attacked by a huge spectral black hound that burst in through the church doors. It would gripe people on the back and leave them shriveled and distended like a leather purse with the strings drawn shut, is how it's described. And the story goes, at least it's told in a pamphlet by Protestant preacher Abraham Fleming in London, that a number of people were killed, the church was struck by lightning, the main steeple of the church fell down, and so on. It's become part of the town's folklore. Really, it's endemic. You go to Bungay, everything's black dog this, black dog that, black dog judo team, black dog football team, black dog antiques, you name it, it's black dog. It's become a central it's a central focus of town identity. If you like, if you go anywhere near Inverness in Scotland, everything's Nessie. In Bungay, everything's black dog. Story from the Protestant Reformation, the 1577 story. In the 1600s, 1700s, it sort of fades away. There's a few stories of things linked to the witch trials from neighbouring areas in 1640s, that sort of thing. Later on, in the 19th century, gets taken up as a symbol of its connection to eternal Celtic and pagan identity. Gets reconfigured for tourism when the town's economy collapses in the 1930s. And today, it's, you know, quite often recycled for popular culture. I think the computer game The Witcher, for instance, has a replay of the Black Dog of Bungay story. There's songs about, you know, pop songs about it, and metal songs about it, that sort of thing. So it's one of those stories coming out of town turmoil and the Reformation that has just taken off like wildfire.
Can you give us some broader context or background to the English black dog stories? I know that there's a strong tradition of those throughout the region. And so how does this fit into the broader context?
Well, black dog stories are pretty much ubiquitous across the entire British Isles, but also through most of Europe. And for that matter, I'd argue they're almost ubiquitous worldwide. I mean, for instance, I was talking to a colleague of mine who's an anthropologist and historian of Australian Aboriginal culture, and he was talking about a story of a black dingo that if it spoke to you would turn you into stone. And I think there's a broader tradition with the role of dogs in general, where they're these animals that sort of sit on the boundary. We relate to them almost like they're human. We anthropomorphize the animals. We engage with them, but they're also creatures as carrion feeders that are associated with death. We think of them as animals on the boundary. They're animals which we love and care for us and so on, but can turn vicious at a moment's notice. So they're these very ambivalent creatures, and I think there's sort of a long tradition of trying to, if you like, use them as symbols on those sorts of boundary areas, those sorts of areas of crisis. So certainly in the time of, well, really right through Britain up until very recently, you also had problems where feral dogs were just everywhere through towns. You know, Bungie, they actually hired a guy whose full-time job was to keep dogs out of the church. The towns are filled with these mangy, sort of semi-tame, semi-wild dogs that could be quite dangerous at the same token, you know, would eat the carrion and all that. They'd bark, they'd scare off intruders and that sort of thing as well. So they're a very ambivalent creature. But again, you find them throughout Britain. You find them going back in traditions really as far back as that sort of thing's recorded.
Interesting.
It'd be cheaper, yeah, instead of hiring somebody to build doors.
it's a bit like, you know what, your dog's like when it wants to sneak in and steal some food or something, and it can be very quick.
Oh, I sure do.
Since you're having lots of them.
Yeah.
One of the traditions, of course, of burying people very deep in cemeteries was that your feral dog could just go and dig them up again and have a free lunch.
It makes me wonder what they're using for communion wafers, anyway.
Oh, there's one little story I found at the time, and I didn't write it in the book, but I just loved it. It was, they made a prohibition in the Church of Bungie, in about 1530 to stop people keeping small dogs in their bodice when they're in church. So, you know, women popping in their, between their boobs, so to speak, in church, and they had to make it was enough of a problem where they had to make a law about it.
Very nice.
So, yeah. In the book, you talk, there's a word you use over and over again, psychopomps. Now, can you explain to our listeners what psychopomps are?
If I'm being, sort of colloquial with it, psychopomps, like the idea of someone who guides you through the afterworld or the spirit world. And so it sort of taps into that notion of, one of the other aspects of dogs, of course, is their role as a guide.
That's neat. I'd never really thought of a dog as a psychopomp, but I know in horror fiction, I know especially like in Lovecraft, the Dunwich Horror has birds as psychopomps and is kind of a key part of that story. But that's
I thought it very interesting itself. And, of course, you have correlations to Greek myth and the like as well with Cerberus and that sort of thing. For that matter, you have one of the forms of the Morrigan, the old Celtic death goddess, was, of course, as well as things like a crow, a huge black dog. So, of course, you've got to be careful making these associations because people are very, particularly in British folklore, people are very quick to assume a continuous line. When what you also have is, say, people writing in the 16th century who read Greek and Roman literature and integrate that into their practice. So, like I've often seen, I think as I indicate in the book at the start, people often go, oh yeah, Egyptian myth, Celtic myth, and then they go through to Bungie, and then they go through the present. And the problem you have with that, of course, is if I'm talking to a 16th century Puritan in Bungie, he's not even going to know what a Celt is, let alone Anubis or something like that. People are very quick to make universal associations, and in part I see that as the legacy of Jungian approaches to folklore. And I see where people assume universal correlations to symbols because of superficial resemblance. And one of the things I tried to do in this book was, instead of just talking globally about black dogs, let's pick a case study of a town where it can get access to specific data about specific people and look at it in its own local context.
See, speaking of Jung, I was going to ask you if you were, if you yourself subscribe to Jungian ideas, because you do talk a lot about the sort of cultural payload that comes with language and bits of language as well as folkloric stories. So I think when I heard about Jung for the first time, I've never read his work, but I always thought it was almost sort of a supernatural theory. But using it in the context of having connotations coming through and then as having a collective memory that's actually built into the stories and social structure sounded a lot more plausible. I may need to go do some reading, but I would like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, now the thing with Jung, Jung, as he writes, and Jung's a very divided character. There's parts of him where he puts himself across in a more, for want of a term, using the rhetoric of science. And there's other terms in which he's quite into spiritualism and so on, which of course was fairly standard for his era. Those sorts of divisions weren't quite as strident as they are today, particularly in psychology. I find Jung useful, but I'm not a Jungian, if that makes sense. For instance, I find the idea of the collective unconscious very dubious. I don't see any weight behind it, but looking at it in terms of symbols that are embedded in our language and our culture as we communicate them in a society, I find a much more productive way to look at it. In terms of things like, for example, relating to my current project, the myth of big cats running around the bush in Australia at the moment, we tend to look for signs when we identify something. And because we look for those little signs or images, we are very quick to make those associations based on cultural terms. And I'll give you a little example of this. A few months ago, I was driving along from Geelong through to Ocean Grove, and there's a area we go through a fair bit of bush. And I saw through the bush there what I thought for a second was a bear. You know, you're driving along, you look to the side and you see what you think's a bear. And I started thinking, what the hell's that? And then, you know, I was able to, you know, pull over and get a closer look. And what it actually was a wild pig with a hairy back. Now, the thing is, coming out of my particular culture, reading things from like Winnie the Pooh from when I'm little, the kind of discussions I have coming from that European background, that sign of the hairy back, when I just see a flash of it for a second, I click, what's the first association? Culturally, for me, goes bear. Even though it's completely implausible, the idea of seeing a bear out there in the otways. So I think bear, and if I'd only had, let's imagine the thing had immediately scurried off into the scrub, I would have gone away thinking I'm a bear, my imagination would have filled in the gaps, so I'd be sitting there thinking, God, I thought I saw a bear. Fortunately, the thing stayed there, I could get a good look and go, no, it's a pig. And that's because you have those little symbols, bits of things that you see, you encounter, and you tend to leap to those kinds of interpretations of your experiences. And in the British case, the black dog myth is so entrenched that it is one of the first things people often jump to. There's lots of little stories, for instance, of people talking about thinking they saw a black dog alongside the road when they're driving in the shadows late at night, and that's like a warning to them they need to pull over and stop, or they're going to have a car accident or something. And you could see, of course, that it's a metaphor for something else, but it is a fairly deeply rooted in people's language and communication. It's a deeply rooted response people look for in that culture. In fact, I was just thinking of, Ben, you wrote a book a while back called Scientific Paranormal Investigations, is that right?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Yeah. Now, there's a bit in there, I remember, you were talking about like a people who thought there was like a haunted house, and they were getting like cold drafts from a spot over the stairs and things like that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, exactly.
I need to have a cultural basis of things I associate with the idea of a ghost, like cold, like certain sounds, certain activities, to even make that association in the first place. And those things are very deeply rooted in our culture, they're rooted in our pop culture, they're rooted in our communication, so that when I feel things like cold, I associate it psychologically with things like the idea of ghost or undeath, whatever the heck happens to be culturally. And some things you can argue are fairly broad. I think Jung makes a good case for mother goddesses popping up quite commonly because it's association that most humans have. That being said, it's in this sense that I find Jung useful. There's these signs and signifiers and symbols that we jump to and give meaning to, but I don't think there's anything universal like a collective unconscious. Rather, it's something to me that's built in our communication, it's built in our language, it's built in our artwork, that we experience and we're immersed in from very little.
I was going to say, I think you're exactly right, and it's interesting that you sort of, you know, you cross, sort of cross-pollinate the topic with ghosts, because in many ways, you know, people seeing, of course, in this case, of course, you've got the blending of monsters and ghosts and animals, sort of this sort of crypto ghostozoology type thing, and you know, and you're exactly right, you know, in terms of, you know, the cultural areas in which, you know, the cultural sources that people, you know, bring to their expectations and experiences.
Completely consistent with Wiseman, Richard Wiseman, who was on recently. His book Paranormality outlays that same sort of idea that it's the cultural luggage you bring with you when you go into the haunted house that's probably more responsible for what you experience.
Yeah, and the ghost association I made was quite deliberate too, because the black dog is at least the Black Dog of Bungie's case, but everywhere else I looked in Britain, and Theodora Brown, who I talk a fair bit about in the book, I went to see her archives at the University of Exeter. She's got just boxes and boxes of old folk stories of ghosts and goblins and all that sort of thing stretching back to the 19th century. It's a wonderful archive to go through. And one of the things with black dogs is that people never talk about them as a flesh and blood dog, like a, you know the way people talk about Nessie and they're expecting to find an actual dinosaur. I never found until very, very recently anyone who for a moment described an encounter with a black dog as a physical animal. There's always things like I'd feel cold in the back of my neck. I'd hear weird sounds, things like that. I'd hear this padding behind me, but wouldn't see anything. Then everything goes silent, and then I'd see the animal materialize in front of me. Or I'd be riding along, and there'd be a dog in front of me, and a car would drive straight through it, and the dog would just be there. Like, they always talk about it as a spectral creature, which is interesting because I've come across some people in other scenes have gone around Bungie trying to put up cameras and things to take photos of the black dog. And the thing that sort of amuses me was I'd never seen anyone ever describe it as a flesh and blood animal. It was always a ghost that brought portents or warning, or in some other stories, guided people. There's some really interesting yarns I've had talking to people who grew up in the Depression and World War II, where they talk about, say, a young woman out on her own, has some guys who are in a bit of a, let's say, aggressively sexual mood. She's going home, she feels really scared, and then she'll see the black dog, she'll be scared, and then she realizes the black dog guiding her and protecting her home. There's a lot of those sort of stories. And it's a thing where it's almost always conveyed as a supernatural experience, and it's always conveyed about you. The dog's there to tell me something. It's warning me about my wife's impending death, or it's helping me get away from these U.S. soldiers on the army base, or it's helping me to find my way home, or it's scaring me, or it's warning me about that there's going to be a car coming around the corner. There's always those stories. And this is where I think kind of put this metaphor for other things. It's a way of aesthetically grappling with profound moments and experiences. Even the original case from 1577, in part it took on because of the chaos of what was happening in the Reformation. You've had people, tearing down and building up all the Catholic and Protestant things. You had people being burnt for heresy in the nearby towns. Things had reached a fever pitch. The conflict going on between Protestant Catholics was really quite brutal and violent. In the middle of this, you have this huge storm. I think it's, fairly appropriate. People put on a huge mythic quality. And in my experience looking at folklore in Britain, ghost stories tend to be very much a way of grappling with profound experiences in your history. You tell a ghost story about a place like Bungie. In telling that ghost story, you remember that part of your past in a really profound emotional way, and it's quite a different function to empirical history. It's a way of investing your past with powerful emotional meaning. And it's interesting, too, because I found, like, Australian ghost stories are often quite different to British ones. In Britain, you'll almost always get it's, Queen Isabella, who was sent to Castle Rising to live in exile while her son took over the throne after she had her husband murdered. They'll have this story, they'll give them this emotional meaning, and it gives a certain profundity to people in the community. And then, of course, later on it gets milked to death by for tourism, which is, of course, the other side of these stories, because, Britain makes a great deal of finance out of manufacturing its ghost stories.
As Scotland does with Nessie.
Yeah, exactly. You go to York and it's like, oh, we guarantee to have the most haunted pub in England. And you're sort of thinking, should the ghost get a cut of that? Or but in Australia, they'll typically go, this pub's haunted. So you buy, some guy. There's no specific history the way I tended to find in Britain where they have a very established function. Part of that is the nature of folklore as a discipline itself, which emerged as a way of maintaining connection with the past and the social disruption of the Industrial Revolution. On the other hand, often they have little stories, like a woman who slept with a landlord, got pregnant, she drowned herself in the dam out front of the house, and they'll have stories about a ghost at this house. But it's a way of keeping a little tragedy alive through constant repetition in a very emotionally poignant way. It's storytelling. And I was always finding people who would tell me a story like this, and I'd start with, people around here are very silly and superstitious. Don't believe what they say. They're all very silly. And then they'd, after a bit, a cup of tea or something, start telling you a ghost story about something. And then go, people here are very superstitious. And it's like, well, you just told me a story about you having an encounter with a ghost, but not to believe you. it's a really interesting sort of duality there. And in the book I wrote, to my mind, it's a lot to do with this. You grow up with a Western scientific education, but you're part of a culture that has these really emotionally pervasive stories that are very deeply rooted in your culture. And so there's this sort of ambivalence between a supernaturalist side and a rational side. And they kind of coexist in a sort of awkward, cognitive dissonance, I'll use it, and that's a bit of an overused term.
And now you've mentioned that people have been searching for actual physical dogs. Have any of these cryptozoologists had any luck with tracking down physical evidence of demon hounds?
No, not that I've ever come across. I should be specific. Di Francis, who was looking at British myths of big cats, similar to the Australian story, made the claim that what people were seeing as big cats were big dogs. And I personally don't buy it at all, because people never talked about big dogs the way they talked about big cats. Whenever people talked about big cats in Britain and Australia, it's like, something's been eating my sheep. I went over and had a look, and oh my God, it was a big cat. Like, they're talking about it like it's a flesh and blood animal that eats sheep, does it sort of thing. Black dog stories were always, walking down the road late at night, I see this black dog, I'm absolutely terrified. It comes, walks through me, and I feel this huge thing of cold, and I go home and find my wife's got cancer, that sort of thing. It's telling you something, it's about you, and it's never flesh and blood. I think it's sort of a bit of a tendency coming out of the whole, Bigfoot being quite central to the whole cryptozoology scene in the 50s and 60s. I think it led to a certain approach where almost anything gets this, we'll run out, we'll stick out cameras and get photos of it and show it's a flesh and blood animal. But if you're not looking at the broader cultural and historical perspective, I think you can miss a lot of the role the animal plays in the culture. One thing I'm arguing in this current book I'm writing on Australian big cat myths, let's imagine you did have a small colony of pumas in Australia coming out of the 19th century or whatever. The cats that just do cat things like any other animal. However, all the social baggage, the stuff from the 60s where people make UFO associations and all that sort of stuff, is another story. And to my mind, that's actually the more interesting story. The way people grapple with an idea, the way they turn it into storytelling, the kind of meaning they put on it. Because if you actually think about it, it's quite an odd idea for people to get so upset about, given Australia's history of introduced animals, a fairly prosaic thing, is there another introduced animal living out the bush that's descended from circus escapees or whatever? And to my mind, that's sort of the more interesting story. And when I was doing The Black Dog of Bungie, I was trying to skirt the issue of getting caught up on is it true or not, and instead look at what's the story that it tells you about the town and the community. I run the line, for instance, in that book that the story of the black dog is basically the story of the town.
I was going to ask you about that because that's one of the sort of recurring themes that we get here. When we looked at, for example, Jay Smith's book on the Beasts of Givadon, he shows how there's a very, very unique social and cultural context for the beast in which, you know, the sightings were happening and the different interpretations that basically spawned and created these stories. So what was the socio-cultural context for the Beasts of Bungie?
For the Black Dog of Bungie, the main social and cultural context was the chaos of the English Civil War and the English Reformation. You know, a complete loss of certainty. You'd been going along for 500 or so years in the region being, yep, we're Catholic, we have a certain relationship to the church, a certain relationship to the king, a certain relationship to our local lords. This is what we do in our religious life every day. We can rock up to our priest to deal with our supernatural life. Everything's all fairly certain. There's common patterns. Then all of a sudden things like the English Reformation get swept away. Oh, we're not meant to do these rituals in the Catholic Church. Oh, okay. We are meant to do them. You know, their religious life became suddenly unstuck. You started to get really violent and brutal conflicts for the region. In the English Civil War, central government breaks down, and of course, because central government breaks down, you get all these moral panics during the English Civil War that lead to the witch trials of Britain, which again, large numbers of people being arrested on very flimsy evidence, lots of social conflict. People are living in a state of conflict. And in living in that state of conflict, they then have to wrestle with this lack of certainty. And the black dog, I felt, was not interpreted, but it was a construction out of that chaos. If you'd suddenly gone from an ordered society to things falling apart like in Somalia, the level of chaos and just panic would be overwhelming. I mean, things like, you know, people are being burnt alive in neighbouring towns. People are being hung for witchcraft in neighbouring towns. It's in that context that I think it really needs to be understood. And then it sort of dies down, but it becomes just a symbol of warning. There's bits and pieces of things in the 18th century of using the black dog as a warning so that smugglers are going to be operating in the district, things like that. But then in the 19th century, it gets taken up as a symbol of connection to the past, once again in a time of social turmoil. The local industries are collapsing, people are being pulled off the land, sent into the city. It becomes, again, a time of turmoil, the black dog story returns, but in this case, in quite a different function, it returns as a way of connecting you to the past. And that legacy to the past sort of helps you preserve your cultural identity. That's the overwhelming context I see in the black dog case.
Or at least I think it was really interesting the way the history unfolded. So when you started looking into it, I mean, I don't want to spoil the book for the readers, because I'm assuming a lot of our listeners will want to actually go get this book, because it is really a great read. And you also did a really good job, just throw this out, that you did a really good job of taking it back to the source and then coming back forward in history. You know, going back, you know what I mean? going back to the original sources to see what's the basis of the story, right? So, but after the initial pamphlet came out describing the event, that wasn't the last we heard of the black dog. This wasn't a singular event. So what else happened? I mean, in history, how has this black dog recurred and manifested itself in Bungay folklore?
We had the original event. We had the story, of course, written by Abraham Fleming in London shortly thereafter. The story then, it comes up again during the English witch trials in a peripheral way. You get people in that region talk about seeing the devil in the form of a hound appear to them through the region in passing roads, things like that. In the 19th century, it starts re-emerging, and it starts re-emerging with a thing where people are going out to rural Britain trying to reconstruct that link to the past. So they go around collecting these stories, and once again, the stories emerge of spectral hounds that bring warning of impending doom, spectral hounds that bring messages from the devil or from God. In the 19th century, it starts to be early 20th century, it starts to be reconstructed as something that can be both a warning but also something positive. You get stories of girls who say, like one particular girl, I found letters she was writing to Theodora Brown in about in the 1920s, I think it was. Actually, 1930, sorry. And she's walking along and talking about how she'd have the black dog walking along beside her and she'd talk to us and things like that. So it starts to emerge again in the early 20th century as partly a way of coming to terms with the past, partly a way of coming to terms with profound events, but it establishes a pattern. But that pattern changes over time from its initial symbol of, you know, utter horror and devastation to becoming something a lot more prosaic and ambivalent, depending on your point of view. People start developing a certain affection for the black dog as a symbol of their town through economic and social crisis. A key point in my story, and especially something I'm very proud of doing in this particular story, was all the material from the 1930s and 40s, which, because it's not linked to that classic skeptic-believer debate, is largely ignored. But if I hadn't have recorded those stories in this book and in my notes in my office, they would have been lost forever. The stories of how that came about, the rebuilding of the castle to reconstruct the town as a symbol of English historic identity as opposed to failed industry. That was quite a deliberate project by Dr. Kane, who took over as town reeve at the time. You had a town that had economically collapsed during the Depression and the collapse of local industries in the late 19th century, and he deliberately set about making a historic town and republicizing the black dog myth in every newspaper it could get a hand on to reinvigorate that story and entrench it. It's still part of school curriculum in Bungay.
And they came to look at the dog in a different vein?
Very much so. They say the town weather vane with the black dog in it, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's a lot on that, and you're finding out who actually designed the weather vane. And yeah, this is something I love with historic research. You go in and you see a town weather vane, you think, okay, so where the hell did that come from? Yeah. People got really upset. You go through the papers, they took it down to get repaired, and everyone was all jumping up and down and being really upset. So there was a great little story from a guy who used to be Anglican vicar in Bungay where people got really enthused about it around about year 2000, and they were going to build for the year 2000 a giant statue of the Black Dog of Bungay in the church out of bronze. And this minister there was saying, you know, guy, how did he put it to me? He said, look, Think about it, guys. You want a giant statue of the devil in such a likeness in bronze in your church behind the altar? Just think about it for a moment as, you know, practicing Christians. Do you want to have a statue of the devil in your church at the altar?
Why not? Mix it up a little bit.
Oh, mix it up a little. I just think it was a really funny image. But, of course, the thing is, in one of the ways I got into this story, of course, was my father was minister of Emmanuel Church in Bungie for quite a while. And you have this, in Bungie, the thing my dad was always talking about was it's very difficult to do anything you can't show a historical link to what you're doing, whether it be where you're holding a market for the summer festival, things like that. Everything has to get given a historic link. And that's, in a sense, the way the Black Dog got configured, from a portent of doom to a symbol of the town. And becoming a symbol of the town, it started to be viewed very positively. People started differentiating the Black Dog of Bungie from the broader myth of Black Shuck from Norfolk. And they started going, basically, our dog's a good dog, the other dog's a bad dog. There's a lot of really interesting little...
That's a reinterpretation, right?
It is a reinterpretation. Another one, and I think this was a really interesting one for me, and it took a bit to find it, was where the myth that the Black Dog of Bungie was the disembodied soul of Lord Bygod, who built Bungie Castle. And I was trying to trace this back, and in the end, the furthest I could trace this back was to a book called Haunted Britain, written in 1973 by a guy called Anthony Hipsley Cox, I think his name was. And what he'd done, got this from Dartmoor, was he integrated the Dartmoor story of the Black Dog linked to Richard Cabell, that's the basis of the Hound of the Baskerville story, and he applied that across to Bungie. He hadn't actually gone to Bungie, but he just applied the story across, looked at their local notorious lord, attached the Black Dog myth to it, and then that took off. And this is something I find really interesting with the spread of folklore. The idea of the dog being Lord Bygod, even though it's recent, catches on. It sits in the way people looked at the dog. Whereas around by people, Janet and Colin Board's argument that, you know, it's linked to UFOs and things like that, and they thought it was hilarious. Now, the thing is, they're both equally irrational, if you like, but one fits in the established narrative of how you think about the dog in the town, the other doesn't. But, of course, the other story linking it to UFOs and things fits really well in the New Agey scene. So they've taken it up there in a way that's quite different to how it's seen in the town itself.
As you've noted, Black Dog sightings remain common in the region. So what's unique about this particular legend, and why did you focus on this one?
Well, key thing when you're doing anthropology is people need to be willing to talk to you and willing to talk to you openly, because a common thing you'll find is you'll go into a community and talk and they'll fill you full of bollocks because they're having fun with you as, you know, a visiting academic and the like. People in rural Britain are legendary for just clamming up and not telling anyone anything. And with my father being minister, visiting the area quite frequently and so on, people knew me, people willing to talk to me, people willing to network with me. Of course, the book was co-written with Chris Reeves, who's creator of Town Museum. He was very happy to work with me on it. And because of that, I was able to get this unique avenue into this story, which I don't know if anyone else would have been able to. And this is a very important factor. I mean, at first, too, when I got into the story, I'd finished doing Sign of the Witch. I was looking around for something else to do, and Dad had recently, at that stage, been made minister there in Emmanuel Church, and I heard the story from Australia, and I went, oh, how cool is that? I've got to go and look at that. And so went over, started to meet people, started to talk to people, started doing the first starting point of any of these sort of projects for me is to do a literature search. And you start going through all the newspapers and things back. And then in doing that, you get a sense of the town. Because one thing people often do in these sort of projects that bugs me a lot is they cherry pick for articles. They're looking for black dogs. They only look for black dog articles. You don't look at the broader context of what's happening in the town, which is a lot more work. But you get little stories about how people are living at the time. There's a great 1700s story where they had this woman who was selling off all her property. She wanted it donated to the church. She didn't want her daughter to get a bit of it. And it was fascinating because it sort of gave me a list of everything someone had had in their house at that era that was on the auction list. But she had this great quote, which was, she was talking about her daughter not being able to receive any of her money because, and the quote went something like, she's the kind of lady whose anklets are in danger of becoming entangled with her earrings. And I went, gosh, that joke's like 400 years old, you know, 300 years old.
Cleopatra, they said that about her.
Yeah, that's what the woman said about her daughter at this auction. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, that tells you so much about what life in the town was like. And if you don't understand what life in that community is like, you can't understand the myth that comes from it. So you have to read broadly around a subject to get a sense of what's really driving people. So that's a key part. And again, people being willing to talk to me was fantastic because then I could sort of network with people. People could pass me on to things. There were lots of things like Dr. Kane, for instance, and Hugh Morgan, who were both very prominent in the town when the town was being reconfigured as a historic town, both kept books of news clippings. You know, that was a fantastic resource. Coming across Thea Brown's archives in Exeter, I mean, I could go through in depth and get a real sense of what's happening, and then I could cross-reference letters. I could talk to people about letters they'd written 40 years ago and get a sense of what they're intending when they sent it. And you know, that, if you like, that's the grunt work of folklore, which a lot of people don't do when they do these sorts of want of a better term, you know, folkloric, supernatural, cryptozoological projects. It's that really broad contextual work that lets you make sense of the story.
And I think all of us here probably experienced before the locals clamming up. And I used to live in Armidale, halfway between Sydney and Brisbane, and was researching the Gyra ghost story a number of years ago and experienced the locals closing in on themselves and not wanting to tell me where the house was located. And so luckily I had an inn who was able to point out the house to me and to connect me to some people who'd be willing to talk with me. So what is a good way for investigators like us, historians, to circumvent the locals closing up?
Well, the first thing was I had the fortune that people already partly knew me, and it's getting to know people on their own terms. I think that's very important to doing that kind of research. The second thing is, of course, do all your preparation. Do your literature search first so you know the people, you know the context, you know the issues, you know other things besides your topic. So in doing that broader research, you can get a broader context of what's going on, so you can talk about other related issues. For example, just recently I was talking to people about the Gippsland panther myth in the 1930s. A key way to get into that was working out the issues at the time, which were coming from an enormous flood that happened that year, the particular year I'm looking at, and also the logging industry at the time. But you need to know broader contextual material, not just go and read all the stuff about... you know, if I was going into internet, I wouldn't just go and read messy articles, but read, you know, what's going on in the 1920s in general in that town. What are the issues they're facing? So you can talk broadly and get a sense of the feel of the town and the people. When you're talking to people, really important, of course, basic anthropological practice, you don't judge people. You talk to them, you let them tell their story, and in letting them tell their story, and talking to them generally about it to get a sense of what they're wanting. It's not for us to, when you're interviewing someone, to try and put judgment on them. It's rather a thing of trying to get a sense of who they are and how they're engaging with the story that they're trying to tell you. And it's a very common thing I've noted some people will do is they'll sort of get very quick to push them to certain types of conclusions or else to try and judge them. And what you need to do instead is let them tell their story their way. Because people will sometimes, to make you happy, tell you what you want to hear. People will often just tell you bollocks to get a laugh out of you. People will have fun having a joke with you. And, you know, you'll have to actually get through that and be able to chat to people as individuals to really get a sense of what the stories mean. It's only when you know what the stories mean in the context of their community that you can really understand the broader context of their local myths, whether it be a ghost story or a black dog or Nessie or a big cat. You know, the overwhelming issue with the big cat story at the moment is the issue of stock losses and people in the 19th and early 20th century seeing Australia as this kind of really alien Gothic landscape. So you'd have the situation of mass stock losses, you'd have this kind of border where on one land this unknown bush, on the other land this nice controlled zone. During the night, things come out, eat your sheep, disappear. And when it starts reaching an epidemic level, largely through things like mass land clearance where the dingoes and the like have got nowhere else to go, it reaches a fever pitch. In the 19th century, this people tended to respond to this by running around in large numbers with firearms, shooting the billy out of this. And those panics then get entrenched in memory, and then the story starts to take a weight of its own. So to get in, you need to read broadly through the media, go do a media search, and you know, read the newspapers. And when I say that, don't just look for your Nessie articles. You look for what's happening in the town and in the economy. What sort of things are front page news that people are obviously concerned about? Get that sense. And once you've got that sense, you talk to people and you just chat to people as a human being. You know, you don't see them as a vehicle or something to give me my data. You chat to them to let them tell their stories their way. And then you start to correlate it with events. You start to correlate it with what other people tell you. And then you can start seeing patterns emerging.
I think you're right. I'm really glad that you brought up the whole issue of doing a literature search. I think all of us here, and as well as our friend Dan Loxton of Skeptic Magazine and others who do this sort of research investigation, one of the main failures that people that we find is that, you know, when someone wants to do investigations, whether it's ghosts or monsters, whatever else, they fail to do a basic literature search. They just think, oh, let me just jump into it. And of course, that's the exact wrong way to do that. You need to spend some time and do some effort and put in some shoe leather in doing that. So I'm really glad you brought that up.
Yeah, and it was interesting because it's relating to discussions, of course, I was having partly with you guys and partly with my cousin Duncan on Facebook. Things like, one thing that really bugged me, the Australian 1020C, I think the group was, and it was sort of a side bit of the Australian Skeptic Society, and they were writing about the big cat myth when it came up in the papers again, as it does every few years. And the guy was saying, you know, if you had big cats out there, you'd have stock losses. And it's like, he hasn't done the most cursory reading of the literature, which is that the primary driving engine going on that causes panics about big cats is stock losses that they can't easily attribute to dogs or have just in some way weeded the farmer out. It's precisely stock losses that's been driving the issue. Now, that comes about because he hasn't read the literature, he hasn't gone and done a media search of newspaper articles about the topic. Mm-hmm. And look, in my view with Australia, most of our newspapers are now digitally available where you can scan them by PDF and do a word search in the National Library of Victoria. There's no excuse for that. You can jump online, type in tiger, look at the period you want and have bazillions of articles and then move on from there. It's a very straightforward thing to do with that digital archive. It's not that difficult, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the difference is that people like you and ourselves recognize that is a step that needs to be done. It's not an afterthought. Mm. It's part of the process. And I think that's where most people fail. It doesn't even occur to them that that's the first step you do when you're researching this. But
yeah, and that's something I've noticed in passing, like, because I have a line where I sort of talk about the skeptics and the pseudo-skeptics. The pseudo-skeptics feel like I'm going to culturally fit in with my scene in terms of social desirability by bagging stuff out. A proper skeptic approaches it, you break it down to specific claims, you evaluate specific claims in their context, and you scientifically go about it. Whereas a pseudo-skeptic is someone who, you know, acts like Dana Scully on The X-Files, you know, giant spaceship lands behind her and aliens come out and she's like, oh no, it's swamp gas. To my mind, the first step, and part of it is you have people from a scientific background doing it, and because they're looking at it from a scientific perspective and they don't have training in the social sciences, they don't think to do the sort of things that a social scientist will do as their first step. Mm-hmm. You know, talking to people, literature search has to be your first step in doing any project, because if you don't understand the context, you don't know what people are meaning. I read a fantastic study of Bigfoot recently. It's become a bit of a model for my current project by a guy called Joshua Booth.
Yes.
It's called Bigfoot, The Making of a Legend. And it's like, I was sitting there thinking, this is fantastic. You know, where he's talking about 19th century folk songs of old Bigfoot and linking that to white Indian relations and things like that. When you understand that context, you can then make sense, and you understand, say, the context of Edmund Hillary and the Yeti business going on in the 50s. You can then make sense of the rise of the myth of Bigfoot.
Well, let me say, when I was reading your stuff, it was interesting. What it brought back for me was that last year at the American Folklore Society's conference, I presented on the Chupacabra and the folklore of the Chupacabra, and I was on a panelist. I was on a panel with other people who were talking about various fantastic creatures and demonic entities, and it was interesting because one of the other people there did some fascinating work on stories of phantom sheep and church pigs in Danish folk tales.
Interesting. Yeah.
It was really interesting, and it sort of reminded me of some of the black dogs and cat stories. And it seemed in those cases with the phantom sheep and pigs, of course, again, it's sort of interesting in that these are obviously not not canines, but they seem to be interpreted as either protective spirits or portents of doom. And you sort of touched on that earlier in terms of, you know, there's this sort of weird paradox where sometimes if you see one, it means you or someone else is going to die. Other times when you see one, it means everything's okay. So what do you think about that?
Well, with the dog case, the argument I make in the book is it relates to the social role we have with dogs. And I start the story with a poor incident where my cat got killed by a big black dog in the front, sorry, my next door neighbor's front yard. And there's this thing where, you know, the dog at the time just seemed like a monster, whereas, I was trying to get the cat off it and failed, and the dog started going mean. I'm sitting there in my gym jams with a bucket of water. This dog pit bull thing up.
It's a good story. It's a good story.
It's a good guy, and I thought it was just very, it's sad for our cat, but it was sort of also appropriate that I had this while I was writing this book. Because the next day, the dog was in the next door neighbor's yard, and it was a perfectly normal dog. It was just brownie color, didn't seem anything like a ginormous. When I was describing it to the council, it was like, you know, some sort of dinosaur or something. The next day, it's a perfectly normal dog. I would have been happy to pass it and all the rest of it. And that's the thing with dogs. You know, how many people die each year because they have the family house pet that they love and loves them, killed their child or something. It's the nature of dogs as an ambivalent creature, and that ambivalent gets projected onto their supernatural manifestations in culture.
Mm-hmm.
That ambivalent role where they're both a threat and a protector. With the farm animals, I don't know enough about the literature of that context to really make an informed opinion to the extent I'd like to. I would also suggest, though, that these places of boundaries often have that dualistic aspect of going either way, positive or negative. You even look at religious belief. You know, angels will be there wonderful and nice, or the next minute they can be horrible beings of destruction. And I think those folkloric stories of creatures in the boundaries will usually have that kind of two-sided aspect to them. And of course, a lot of this is concealed with the 19th century, where angels get all made into nice cherubs and fairies become happy little things that wave wands. But in the broader historic sense, they're typically very ambivalent creatures. Creatures that can be malevolent and horrific and malicious and sadistic, and things that can be wonderfully kind and caring, depending on their engagement with you in the particular context of the story.
It's also interesting, just real quick, that takes me back to some of my lake monster investigations, where you have lake monsters such as Champ and Lake Champlain and Ogopogo and Lake Okanagan that on one hand are viewed as these, you know, scary monsters. I mean, these are large creatures that could easily kill anybody, and in some cases, like in Ogopogo, have been claimed to. And on the other hand, they're this warm, cuddly, furry, cute mascot that's very lovable. And so you have the same sort of, you know, positive and negative, good and evil paradigm.
I was reading a recent book on Yowie, sort of the Australian version of Bigfoot, and had a similar thing where, cute, cuddly, lovable thing, and then people would talk about seeing it where they'd, again, it's just like a black dog and fungi story. They talk about, you know, hearing the animal move through the bush where they couldn't see it, and then they started feeling this unreasoning terror, then they'd see it, and then they managed to calm themselves and it went away. It was this really, so much like a black dog and fungi story where the animal's sort of responding to you, it's all about you, and it can be fearful. At the same token, people will tell cuddly stories and have this little furry thing. A friend of mine got me a little cuddly toy yeti sitting on my bedside table. It's a funny little ambivalence, but again, it's the social role we ascribe to the creatures. It's the social role that comes out of creatures that are on the boundary that can sort of go either way. You know, for good or ill, depending on their point of view. Ghosts have the same story. Some people talk about it as like a wonderful blessing kind of story. Other people talk about it in terms of absolute unreasoning terror.
Yeah, that sort of frame of how the story's framed inside your head is probably kind of critical to what the experience is going to be like. I imagine a frightening poltergeist experience versus the comforting ghost of a recently passed relative, for example. It's a different way to take it. But your book covered a lot of really interesting historical material. And I know, personally from having just come off of something like a 4 or 5 month werewolf inquiry, it can be really addictive to kind of try to get to the bottom of these kind of questions, about the historicity of the matter. So in your research, what does the actual historical record have to say about this? I mean, I actually know the answer because I read your book, but could you talk to our listeners a little bit about what you actually found about the original event? Because I found that very fascinating.
Yeah, well, the original event had that, if I, to sum up, you did have a storm, and the storm was recorded in the church registrar. 2 years later, they're talking about still needing to do repairs to it. They wrote that two men were killed by a lightning strike in the church steeple when they were ringing the bells, which is a common medieval practice to scare away spirits. Abraham Fleming wrote it in London. There's no indication that he even went to Bungie. It's something that, a story that he heard through the grapevine that he decided to use as a vehicle for his own particular religious agenda. And that's really the guts of the original story. Because records amongst the general populace and a largely literate society are so sketchy, we don't know exactly how it became entrenched in the Bungie myth, but nonetheless, the original story has no weight to it.
I found that really, really interesting because it always seemed odd to me, having read about it, that a demon hound would come into a church. And that one element that I was missing, that the story itself originated at a different church, it kind of gives it a lot more plausibility as a PR move, you know, or just maybe, if not deliberate PR, a way to vocalize the frustrations between two religious communities, you know?
The Catholic story itself in Bungie is a really interesting one because after that event, they largely went underground, and it's only in the 19th century that they emerged. They were largely practicing illegally, practicing Catholicism illegally under the care of the Lord of Flixton Manor. And that family maintained basically secret links to the continent and the Catholic Church and performing Catholic Mass illegally. Up until quite recently, where the Catholic population saved up enough money to buy the church. It's actually the newest church in Bungie, but they have an enormous attachment to it because it's like this, symbol of finally being able to come out of the closet as Catholics without fear of persecution. And that's like a really fascinating little undercurrent because one of the key side effects of that story taking off as it did was it put an end to the Catholic-Protestant rivalry by forcing the Catholics underground. And again, the fact, like, there's a little book written, the name of it escapes me, but one of the Catholic priests wrote a history of the Catholic Church in Bungie from the 16th century, and a lot of it's this real story of maintaining faith in the face of large-scale Protestant persecution. And, you know, that story is really interesting. One of the things about the witch trials is that the intensity with which Britain wanted to separate itself from the continent meant that there was this kind of orthodoxy that built up in the 19th century and really to the late 20th century that portrayed Britain as nice, rational and stable and sensible and the continent full of nutty supernaturalist wackos ripping people up for witchcraft. And of course, in doing so, they ignored their own traditions of doing precisely that because it suited the English national identity to construct themselves as rational people. And you see that at the end of the English witch trials where you have public, I think Jane Wenham, it's one of the last, about 1712, was one of the last successful convictions of a witch in England. Jane Wenham was brought up, and Judge Powell had come out from London. You know, the people are expecting him to jump in and support their claims that this woman is a witch. And instead, you have things like, they bring evidence saying all these people have seen her flying over the town in a broomstick. And Judge Powell said, "That's a great line. There's no laws in England that prohibit the practice of flight." I just love that. You sit there trying to get to this joke, and you can just see Judge Powell going, "Oh my God, look at these nutters." You had evidence, you burnt your evidence because it's for the devil, so you don't actually have any evidence, and then she gets a successful conviction anyway because all the locals in the jury are, wanting to get this woman. And you can see that kind of split where England starts to really overtly push this rationalist line as a way of separating itself from the continent and trying to insulate itself against Catholic infiltration. And there's this, it's a really interesting dynamic. And of course, the Black Dog of Bungie story is tied into that particular mythology.
Are there similar stories from different times and places around the world? And could maybe tell us about some of the other famous spectral hounds?
Well, okay. Well, for starters, of course, you have the Black Hound of Dartmoor, which there's a collection of legends, but some of them talk about the black dog running ahead of a chariot with a headless driver. You've got the story of Squire Richard Cabell, which is the Black Dog of Bungay story is entangled in the origins of Hound of the Baskervilles by Arthur Conan Doyle. But the main centre for the story is that of Squire Richard Cabell, who's, if you like, the model of Henry Baskerville. Henry Baskerville, I think, is named after Arthur Conan Doyle's coachman. Squire Richard Cabell, he had a reputation for being, as they called him at the time, a monstrously evil man, partly because he was on the wrong side in the English Civil War, partly because it does seem like he did have a nasty reputation. You know, he's accused of murdering his wife. It actually turned out that his wife had escaped to London. Stories of him going out and kidnapping young women from villages that he liked the look of, having his way with them, letting them loose and hunting them down with dogs and so on. Those are the stories that float around about him. Anyway, the story goes, you know, getting killed by one of his own dogs, which is actually a myth, but nonetheless it stuck because it fitted the narrative that was going on at the time. And it has stories like, you know, on I think it's his birthday on July 5th, if I have that correct, I don't have the material in front of me. The story is, you know, he roams the roams Dartmoor with a pack of black hounds hunting people. You know, Australia's got a few variations of black hound myths. There's a little town called Chiltern now, but was for a long time called Black Dog, after Black Dog Creek, because there's an 1836 story where a guy encountered this supernatural black dingo that became established into town folklore. There's black dog stories, of course, there's black shuck from all over Norfolk, that again, like Bungay, appears as a warning. Black shuck was also, in the 19th century context, meant to be a shape-changing creature. It could appear like a person, but its natural shape was that of a huge black hound. Really, pretty much anywhere you go through Britain, there's all sorts of variations. In Yorkshire, of course, you have the Barghest, again, huge demonic black hound. Again, creatures of boundaries, creatures that are taken in the public mindset as a connection to an eternal Celtic British identity. And I say Celtic because they usually link it back to the story of the Morrigan and that sort of thing. Of course, black dog coming out of a lot of these stories became used as a euphemism for depression. You know, Winston Churchill's Black Dog, the Black Dog Institute in Australia, which manages depression studies and the like. So they're very endemic stories in, well, pretty much the world over. I've got an article, I haven't got into it properly yet, of talking about a related Native American myth of black dogs and things. So this fairly ubiquitous around the world.
Well, let me ask you about that in terms of the role that dogs play in broader mythologies. Of course, you can go back to Cerberus, you know, the three-headed hound from Greek and Roman mythology, which, as I recall, guarded the gates of the underworld. And in that case, you had the monster's role in most of the stories, as I recall, wasn't so much as a portent of death, but a guardian. And, you know, you didn't want to encounter it, but on the other hand, beyond there was the underworld. So how can you talk a bit about the canid role in mythologies?
Again, when you talk about the canid in mythologies, basically mirrors the role that dogs have in our social engagement with it in most cultures. They're guardians, but it's one of the first things we use our dogs for. You know, the black dog of Bungay is often associated with the castle as a guardian of it. So you have that role as a guardian, you have that role as the guide, the thing that can take you through, you know, to help you travel through the underworld as a guide, and of course that's mirrored in Bungay stories. The dog is a carrier to feeder. An argument put forward by a few writers, Theodora Brown amongst them, who I'm hoping to write a biography of at some point in the future. Dogs as carrying feeders, you know, going back to, you know, the Egyptian Anubis, and of course the Morrigan is a, you know, goddess of death, but, you know, the carrying feeders, the crow and the dog. Because of that carrying fixation, the fixation on graveyards and things in Britain where they, you know, look at digging people up to eat, the dogs are closely associated with death, and because of that fixation on death, they become seen as something linked to the boundary between life and death. So those sort of roles get repeated frequently over and over again, and I see the mythology as a reflection of our personal engagement with dogs with a vastly long history. Well, pretty much all of these mythologies that come across are reflections of our actual engagement with dogs in our society as a domesticated, or for the most part a semi-domesticated animal. An animal that, you know, all those, for instance, most, up until very recently, most towns had a whole bunch of semi-domesticated dogs that are part wild, part domestic. They'll have a nip at you, but at the same token, they live off your food, they ward off intruders and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how I'd see it. Similar thing, you know, you want to go back to Egyptian stories of, you know, Anubis and the like. Again, you have a carrion feeder associated with death on that boundary.
But for example, I mean, I'm sort of thinking as contrasted, say, with cats. I mean, you have black cats associated with bad luck and witches and familiars, but you don't necessarily have that association with death, as far as I know.
Yeah, and I would argue that that's relating to that we have that control over dogs. Cats are not as closely associated with carrion, but they're also more distant to humans. They're more, they play almost more of a mythic trickster kind of role.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more of an unknown thing. In Australian big cat mythology, they're a lot more like this unknown predator that comes out, and precisely because you can't identify it, it becomes like this trickster thing like a cat. You can see that in the jokes people put up on Facebook and the like about cats. Cats are these ambivalent things. You don't know their intention. They live in your home, but they're not dependent on you the way a dog is. They don't relate directly to you the way a dog does, where a dog's quite deeply entangled with you and your social life. Again, cats have a very prominent role. And look, one thing I find really fascinating with the Australian myth of big cats and the bush eating stock and the like is the way in which it's brought about historically, almost unreasoning terror, supernatural associations, and all the rest of it for something that, if it was there, was just, it's an animal, you know. It wants to meet lady cats or boy cats. It wants to eat a sheep or a wallaby or whatever. It wants to do its thing. But the intensity of the focus, the way in which it has people flying off the handle, is really quite remarkable and out of all proportion to the actual claim being made. Tim Winton, a fairly famous Australian novelist, wrote a novel called In the Winter Dark and has these four people in a little valley, you know, mostly yuppies and things have moved out the countryside, to have a big cat come through a night, a few fleeting glimpses of dead goat, a bunch of dead chickens and the like, and it sort of starts as this catalyst where in the end people are shooting each other and running around mad. It has had that kind of impact in Australia, but you think it's actually not no bigger deal than, say, dingoes attacking people and so on, which occasionally happens. It's not really a bigger deal, so why is it so intensely fixated upon and supernaturalized? And I think part of it is relating to that mythic role of cats as this ambivalent, uncontrolled, sneaky trickster figure that is, again, difficult to control. Again, that thing of boundaries I'm finding all the time here between habit, you know, controlled agricultural land and bushland, where you don't really know what's there. And I think cats have that really profound impact in that respect. And I think even house cats have that. The way people talk about house cats is, you know, you don't own a house cat owns you. You don't see that thing that's been making the web rounds of your cat's trying to kill you. Have you guys seen that at all?
Yes, I've seen that, and sometimes I'm pretty sure my cat is trying to kill me.
Mine too, definitely.
But there's a whole set of signs that we associate with cats and cat-like people and that sort of thing. And again, that wild, uncontrolled, but also sensual and trickster thing. I mean, hell, look at the figure of Catwoman from comic books. It's that real ambivalent role that, well, at least we give cats in our particular culture.
What's happened to Bungie, the town, since it's sort of leashed itself to this history of the black dog?
You're meaning in the more recent period where it's been taken up for tourism and the like?
Mm-hmm. How's it faring?
In Bungie today, everything is the black dog. You know, black dog antiques, black dog movie theatre, black dog karate. Anything in Bungie, you can stick a black dog and it's got a black dog in it. It's black dog forms a major part of their summer festival. It's part of the school curriculum for all the students in the town. Everyone has to do the black dog story. They draw pictures of the black dog. They're taken to all the black dog sites. Chris Reeve is the creator of the town museum. He dresses up as a monk and he goes and does a poem story of the black dog as part of the summer festival that everyone goes to in St. Mary's Church. It was actually funny. When I was there last, he had a wink at me as he walked by in his monk outfit going, oh, by the way, I'm off to propagate the myth that Lord Bygod is a black dog. And, you know, off he goes, and that's what you do in the town. The town is intensely focused on the black dog. It's promoted very heavily locally. There's a band called The Darkness, a metal band from Lowestoft. They took the story, put it into one of their songs off the album. It's the album called Failure to Launch, I think it was. They run it through. Really, it's more and more part of the town. It's getting more of the sort of tourist kitsch thing going on as time's developing. But that being said, the undercurrent of folklore is still there. I met quite a few people, you know, who tell stories about, you know, like going off and closing the gates of their farm and seeing the black dog there watching them and things like that. You know, those stories are still very common. They're still part of the broader folklore.
Is it well received? Is it working financially? Like, I think of Roswell, New Mexico, like, because they've got, like, there's the UFO culture, and it's all over the place. But then everybody else is like, oh, I wish they weren't doing all this UFO stuff.
Look, I found mostly everyone loved it. Like, I met very few people. There was the minister who actually wrote a novel about the black dog, so again, that ambivalence. He wrote a novel about it called The Kettle Chronicles, where he wrote it like a Father Cadvale-style murder mystery, where a guy was using a black dog to kill people in relation to, I think, people's inheritance and all that sort of thing. But anyway, this particular minister, when I was talking to him about it, he said, sort of got exasperated at one point. He said, look, he said, it's the only bloody thing that's ever happened in that bloody little town, and no wonder they go on about it. That's what he said to me. And so that sort of, there's a bit of that cynicism, but by and large, people seem to be very anxious to celebrate it, and again, they've used the education system there to enculturate it into the whole population. You know, kids will do the black dog in school, they'll draw pictures of it, kids start getting nightmares about the black dog, and that becomes part of the culture. And yeah, and by and large, it's celebrated. People seem to really love it. They're very affectionate. Whenever anyone does anything to some of the black dog symbols around the town, there's a huge space of letters in the newspapers and things saying how terrible it is that you took down the weather vane or that you moved this sign or whatever it was. Because they see it as part of their town heritage and their town identity.
Well, so, David, I was just going to ask you our final question. What's your favourite monster?
Well, what's my favourite monster? I do really like the black dog. I am finding the big cat thing quite fascinating at the moment, but also very frustrating. But I'll stick with the black dog at the moment because I really enjoyed the story and it was a great culture and it was a great experience writing it.
It's a fine book, too. Good job.
Yeah, we enjoyed it.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Monster Talk. You've been hearing an interview with David Waldron, author of Shock, The Black Dog of Bungie. Your hosts were Blake Smith, Ben Radford, and Karen Stolzno. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. Thanks to all of you who've contributed to our show's transcription fund. We have new transcripts coming out very soon. Special thanks this week to Robert Smith, Philip Stratton, Blackbird Studios, and Maxwell Ree. We have some fun interviews coming up on monstrous creatures, both well-known and obscure. I hope you'll stay tuned. Sound effects for today's episode are all from freesound.org, and links to the particulars are in the show notes. Monster Talk theme song is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
The Egyptian link to cats is still very strong. You have Bast, the female cat-headed goddess, and people who like cats are, I think, known as bastards.
I don't know.